I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Ballot Talks on Radio Times. The Republican Party has a lot to celebrate this week with decisive wins in races across the country for U.S. Senate, for governor, and in local contests. Here's a montage of some of the victory speeches on Tuesday night from Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, Governor Scott Walker of Wisconsin, Senator-elect Joni Ernst of Iowa, Senator-elect David Perdue of Georgia, and Senator Pat Roberts of Kansas. Let's give it a listen.
For too long, this administration has tried to tell the American people what's good for them and then blame somebody else when their policies didn't work out. Tonight, Kentucky rejected that approach.
We're excited about the next 4 years. We're excited about the fact that instead of doing what they tried to do with the groups out of Washington who wanted us to be against something, we were for something. We were for a better Wisconsin, for better schools, for a better university system, for a better technical college system, for a better economy, for a better future for our children and our grandchildren.
It's a long way from Red Oak to Washington. From the biscuit line at Hardee's to the United States Senate. But thanks to all of you, we are heading to Washington. And we are going to make them squeal.
Georgia wants somebody to fight for them, though. I heard that loud and clear in the state. And Bonnie and I are committed to go to Washington and fight for you, and not the special interests and not the insiders in Washington, but you, the Georgians that we love.
We said for months that the road to a Republican majority in the United States Senate led through Kansas, and we did it.
Democrat Tom Wolf was an outlier on Tuesday night when he beat Pennsylvania Governor Republican Tom Corbett. Here's what he said that night.
This is a place that deserves to have a great future. We need to expect a lot of ourselves. And if we do, we can do great things here. So here's my message. Let's make this the time. Let's make this the place, Pennsylvania. Let us be the people to actually create this bright future we deserve. Let's make this the time. Let's get started. Thank you very much.
Today on Ballot Talks on Radio Times, what the results of the midterm elections mean for the GOP, the White House, the Democrats in Congress, and the future of the legislative process. And we have two guests who have joined us. Here in our Philadelphia studio is Dick Pullman, political columnist with WHYY's Newsworks.org. He's also writer in residence at the Center for Programs in Contemporary Writing, and that's at the University of Pennsylvania. Dick, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
My pleasure, Marty.
Also joining us, and actually joining us by telephone, is Betsy Woodruff. And she's a political writer for Slate. And Betsy, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Sure thing. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And to our listeners, we want to hear from you what you make of all those election results on Tuesday night. You can give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Betsy, let me begin with you as you read the tea leaves of the Tuesday night election results. What do you think the voters were trying to say to their elected officials and to Washington in general?
I think what struck me about this election is that more so even than being an anti-incumbent election, it was a very anti-Washington election. If you look at, you know, listening to those victory speeches, particularly to what Governor Walker said in Wisconsin, you know, he's an incumbent who won re-election, but for his entire race, he emphasized that it was him versus Washington, him versus the D.C. special interests. So this race wasn't just throw the bums out, I think, so much as it was people wanting a chance to vote for someone who they didn't associate with dysfunction and an incompetence, real or perceived, in Washington.
Dick, how do you read those tea leaves?
I would dovetail with some of what Betsy just said. People have been running against Washington for, you know, many generations. I mean, that's how Jimmy Carter got into the White House out of nowhere. And it happens to be that, you know, Democrats are, you know, have been in control, talking about the Senate specifically, and of course in the White House, Democrats are in control. They're the incumbents. And so they're the prime targets. And I think also you also factor in the history here of presidents in their sixth year in office. Presidents in their sixth year, two-term presidents, typically have horrible, midterm fortunes for their party. I mean, you can even go all the way back to, you know, Franklin D. Roosevelt in 1938.
So this is, I mean, not unexpected. And it seems clear that looking back over the last couple of months is that part of, and I'll put this to you, Betsy, part of what the Republicans did was to associate all these candidates with President Obama. And it's interesting to think about in 94, 20 years ago, Newt Gingrich had this contract with America. It's hard to know what the contract, what the Republicans as a party are offering the American people.
Yeah, this particular election was not super policy heavy from Republicans. We're not hearing Republicans running on particular policy changes they were proposing or particular laws that they wanted to put in place. I think there were two central things that every single Republican who won talked about. One was opposition to the Affordable Care Act, and another was just tying their opponents to President Obama. In Georgia, for instance, David Perdue, who just defeated Democrat Michelle Nunn in his debate, I think he must have said five or six times, "And that's why a vote for Michelle Nunn is a vote for Barack Obama." You know, the winning strategy, the strategy that worked, was saying if you vote for a Democrat, you're voting for Obama. And in a number of these states that tend to be more red, in particular Alaska, Arkansas, Georgia, even Kansas, votes, you know, there's such a distaste, and the president's approval ratings are so low that becomes a very easy way for Republicans to distinguish themselves, you know, and whether that's fair or not.
Well, and Dick, and this has been said before, but certainly a number of Democrats, including in Kentucky, basically saying, I'm not going to tell you if I voted for the president or not. Do you think that in hindsight, do you think that was saying something to voters about the Democratic Party and maybe even raising mm-hmm. questions about the quality of some of these candidates?
Well, you know, the tricky thing that a lot of Democrats had, particularly again in the South, Obama is highly unpopular, but their candidates also needed – they needed strong turnout still from the Democratic base. And as Allison Grimes in Kentucky, when she was asked, did you vote for Obama yourself? You know, here's someone who was an Obama delegate at the convention. And for her to not say who she voted for, and it's, oh, the integrity of the privacy of the ballot box and all that, I mean, it comes off as a bit spineless. And it's not exactly a great motivator for you know, for Democratic turnout. So, you know, it's partly, I think, a referendum. Yeah, Obama became a really convenient and effective punching bag. But not to sort of spring our little conversation forward a little bit. Right. I mean, I just posted something this morning on my blog about the fact that, you know, it's weird. Maybe you can call it cognitive dissonance. I don't know. But you've got voters who are very you know, down on Obama's performance. But when you actually look at the issues in the campaign, you look at the exit polls, you look at the ballot referendums state by state, you can almost argue that the voters this year, a midterm electorate, which is actually probably arguably more Republican than a presidential year, still was supporting all kinds of center-left stuff, you know, everything from marijuana legalization to wage, minimum wage hikes across the board. So it's kind of like the White House is being faulted not so much on policy, but for failing to deliver effectively on policy.
Betsy, in fact, let me read something that Dick wrote in his blog today. And he says, at a time when Republicans in Washington continue to insist that raising the minimum wage would kill jobs and wreak havoc on the economy, the voters in four red states, South Dakota, Arkansas, Alabama, and Nebraska, approved ballot measures by landslide margins to raise the minimum wage. And from Dick's perspective, it's sort of a mixed message coming from voters, if you know, it's possible to dissect it that way.
I think what's interesting about that is that it shows that these minimum wage issues are not necessarily politically winners for Democrats, because successfully the minimum wage gets raised by these ballot initiatives, and we see a number of voters, you know, as he points out, who want a higher minimum wage but also want a Republican representing them in Congress. So whether or not this is cognitive dissonance, I think it's a significant problem for Democrats, because it shows that they can get the minimum wage raised without converting independent voters or maybe center-right-leaning voters to these center-left Democratic voting habits. So it's kind of funny because it's Democratic policies that can get pushed forward by people who otherwise are not going to vote for Democrats.
Dick, picking up on that and going back to you, and one of the arguments that's been made about the disaffection maybe Democrats feel for the president and the party is that so many people in the middle class or in the struggling middle class have not felt the benefits of this booming stock market, of even the falling unemployment rates, that has just not been experienced by a huge swath of the country. Do you think that in any way played in these elections?
Yeah, I would recommend to listeners, actually, there was a piece in the Washington Post yesterday by one of their actually liberal bloggers, Greg Sargent is his name, and he interviewed Democratic pollsters on that very issue. And they basically were saying that this was their failure. This was the Democratic message failure the macro numbers, record high Dow, low jobless rate, plunging jobless rate, whatever it is nationally, 5.9, is not resonating with everyday people in their everyday lives. They're not seeing it. And so the opening for Republicans in this race, and there were some great examples around the country, was that the wage stagnation, which has been a problem for decades among presidents of both parties, by the way, persists. And so people are in a wage inequality way. And so every once in a while, Obama will say something about it. He'll make a speech about it. But people don't feel the economic fairness. They don't feel the economic fairness. And there was a really interesting exit poll statistic this week that said that, who does the U.S. economy work better for, the wealthy or is fairness for all Americans? And in this midterm electorate, something like 64%, I think, said that it favors the wealthy. So you've got this, you still across the board, left, right, center, have this kind of populist yearning for more, fairness and higher wages among the average working person. And a lot of Republican candidates successfully talked about that.
You wanted to talk about that, Betsy?
Yeah, I think an important detail to keep in mind when we're talking about people's perception of the economic recovery is the fact that a lot of this recovery only benefited the upper echelons of the wealthy people in American society. There's a study from UC Berkeley that I've got pulled up that shows that 95% of income gains between the years 2009 and 2012 went to the top 1%. So, of course people aren't going to feel this recovery because, as was pointed out, a lot of these macro numbers don't necessarily trickle down to voters who aren't seeing their wages going up, aren't seeing it easier for their kids to get good jobs out of college. And that sense of dissatisfaction is very difficult to counter, even with the best messaging that you can do.
Betsy, we're almost up at a break, but do you think that kept people home and perhaps even kept Democrats home?
I think so, yeah. I think voters are much more excited to vote when the economy is doing well. And when there's this perception of sort of malaise and of dissatisfaction, that's a problem. It's a very big problem for the party in power.
And that's Betsy Woodruff. She's a political writer for Slate who joins us along with Dick Pullman. He's a political columnist for WHYY's newsworks.org. And we are talking about the Tuesday election results, talking about some of the trends. What are the voters saying? We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. And to you, give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Time. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen talking with Dick Pullman and also talking with our other guest, Betsy Woodruff, about the election returns on Tuesday night, where the country goes from here. And I do want to play two clips back to back. This is Barack Obama, Mitch McConnell giving respective press conferences yesterday. They were talking about the potential to reach across the aisle and work together in the next 2 years. Let's listen, beginning first with President Obama.
I would enjoy having some Kentucky bourbon with Mitch McConnell. I don't know what his preferred drink is, but my interactions with Mitch McConnell, he has always been very straightforward with me. To his credit, he has never made a promise that he couldn't deliver. And, he knows the legislative process well. He obviously knows his caucus well. He's always given me, I think, realistic assessments of what he can get through his caucus and what he can't. And so I think we can have a productive relationship.
The relationship I have with the president has always been cordial. I mean, there's not a personality problem here or anything like that. I think my attitude about all this at this point is trust but verify. I mean, let's see. The American people have spoken. They've given us divided government. The question for both the president and for the speaker and myself and our members is, what are you going to do with it? And I've already said, I want to first look for areas of that we can agree on, and there probably are some. And that's what we're going to be talking about in the next few weeks.
So, Dick, how long do you think this will last?
Kumbaya periods, I think, get shorter and shorter in this particular climate that we're in. There was an interesting moment yesterday on right after the votes came in, where one of the senators, who's the chairman of the Republican Senate campaign arm, Jerry Moran, was asked, I think it was on Morning Joe, whether midterm voters had sent a message to the new Republican majority. And he said, yeah. And he said the message was, this is a quote, demonstrate that you can govern, demonstrate that you can work together to solve the country's problems. So the hitch here is, and this goes back to what you said at the top, I think, is that what is their proactive policy agenda that actually a majority of Americans would agree with? You know, I mean, the exit polls said, classic example, the exit polls said yesterday that 57% of 57% support immigration reform, path to citizenship, immigration reform. Yet Republicans in both chambers have blocked it. Where's the cooperation going to come? Can Mitch McConnell, who I understand is a very great admirer of the Kentuckian from the 19th century, Henry Clay, who was known as the great compromiser, be Clay-like when he's got people like Ted Cruz and people on his right breathing down his neck?
Well, let me go back to you, Betsy, and even going back to 2009 when Mitch McConnell and some others said, I guess famously or infamously, that their goal was to make Barack Obama a one-term president. And I contrast this with the kind of olive branch that we heard from Mitch McConnell yesterday. And I guess the question is, will the real Mitch McConnell stand up? How do you understand what he's saying?
I think we can expect to see, the first thing is Mitch McConnell, as a human being, is not a bombastic person. He's very even keel, very mild-mannered, I would say, kind of the opposite of Ted Cruz, just by disposition. McConnell does not do campaign and press stunts. So my guess is that Republicans are going to emphasize tax reform, first off. I know that's something that Paul Ryan has been very interested in. There's a lot of chatter about Republicans looking for a way to change the tax code without necessarily raising or lowering the net amount of taxes the federal government intakes, but just making it simpler and easier to use. That's very tricky because there are so many special interests involved in the tax code, but it could theoretically be doable. And I think that's something that's an important thing to keep an eye on that McConnell might be thinking about right now. I think another thing that we can expect or keep an eye out for is Republicans looking for a way to do immigration reform without including a pathway to citizenship. Pathway to citizenship is really a poison pill for a huge portion of the Republican base. You know, they call it amnesty. There's an argument that people enter the country illegally shouldn't have a say in how we make our laws, and that's just a non-starter for a significant bulk of House and Senate Republicans. However, I think there's a number of changes in immigration policy that Republicans could get behind as long as that path to citizenship isn't there. And if we get a bill or a set of bills that does that, then it puts Democrats in a very tricky position. So I wouldn't be surprised to see Republicans passing things in that vein, things that are doable, you know, that are politically doable for their caucus, that maybe give the president a tiny bit of potential heartburn.
Well, taking even going back to the press conference yesterday when immigration was being discussed and what the president seemed to say is to Congress, if you don't do something, I have this thing in my back pocket, this executive action. I can do this by myself. How do you understand that? I guess the back and forth there.
Oh, you're asking. Okay.
I'm asking you.
Yeah, okay. Well, that is, it's going to be interesting to see how far he wants to go with that. He has said all along, he's drawn, I hate to use this term, but he's drawn a red line on this notion that he intends to take executive action on some aspects of path to citizenship. That is, of course, a red flag. I'm using a lot of red here today. That's a red flag for a lot of people in the Republican base and people, some of the senators and Republican senators who are basically saying if he goes ahead and does that, that's going to gin up this notion that we should start impeachment hearings. And I don't think the I word, frankly, is anything that the Republican leadership really, really wants to deal with here. It would get things you would go brinksmanship much too fast. So I don't know if – does Obama really want to push it that far? Does he feel he has enough political leverage to push it that far? I just ask that as an open question. Right. I'm also interested to see – just if I can switch for a second. Sure. I'm also interested to see how – talking about McConnell – what would he do with Obamacare? I mean, you know, he said during the campaign at certain points that, you know, he wants to tear it out, quote unquote, root and branch. And then he said in an interview just recently that, well, we don't have the votes for it. It's not realistic. We'll never get 60 votes to get rid of it. And then there was such a backlash on the right from that that then he walked back those comments. So is he going to, you know, is he going to push hard for that or not? And then what happens if he does or doesn't with his own base?
To you, Betsy, I mean, do you see Mitch McConnell then sort of not necessarily caught, but in the middle between two different and perhaps powerful forces within his own party?
I don't think there's a powerful force in the Republican Party arguing not to significantly change or get rid of the Affordable Care Act. There are, you know, plenty of Republicans who said that the odds of repeal are basically zero, said that we need to reform it, change it, rather than talking about repealing it. But I don't think that's necessarily a dominant factor that's organized. However, naturally, there is a significant sector of the Republican Party that says repeal or bust. They don't even want to see the Affordable Care Act be improved because they don't want to siphon off actors who might help repeal in the future. For instance, a number of conservatives pushed to repeal the medical device tax, but other people on the right who want to get rid of the Affordable Care Act say, don't do that, because if you repeal the medical device tax, then the medical device industry is no longer going to have a dog in that fight, and the Republican Party loses an ally going forward. I think it's also important to note, just going back to something Dick mentioned earlier,
sure,
that the impeachment rumors, these things come up. There are enough wacky, weird, unusual personality types in the House Republican caucus that you give it enough time and somebody will bring up the I word, and, you know, then Speaker Boehner will just start bleeding from the eyeballs. But the odds of there being impeachment hearings are basically zero, even if the president was to move forward on this executive amnesty. I think you're more likely to see senators like Jeff Sessions from Alabama push for the House and Senate to pass policies that officially would limit the president's ability to use executive actions for these kind of issues. I don't know how much teeth Congress has on that issue, but that's something people can expect to hear about going forward.
How about the K word, the Keystone XL pipeline? And I know you just exhaled there, Dick Pullman, but at the same time, I mean, that's something that the Republicans have been pushing for. The president so far has kind of dodged making a decision about it. But I'm looking at you, Dick, do you see there's going to be some kind of pressure on this issue, or is it too soon to tell?
Well, you know, talk about McConnell having counter pressures. Obama's got counter pressures on this and has for a long time. You know, labor wants it because it's jobs, not necessarily a huge amount of jobs, but jobs. But the environmental, I don't want to say lobby. It sounds like a pejorative.
Groups
within his constituency, despise it. And so he's going to anger somebody no matter what he does. And so, you know, he's had all these convenient punts that have gone on now for several years. I think actually, you know, I think I hate that we use this word optics, the political optics. But what I think with the political optics, the worst aspect of it for him is just that he's not making a decision. Right. I mean, I think that there's a feeling, you know, a general impression of him in the country, which probably hurt him in the midterms, is that he's too passive and not decisive enough, and that he lets things marinate too long. And so regardless of what the merits or demerits of the Keystone Pipeline are to the average person, I think they factor in the way he's handling it or not handling it.
Things like the VA scandal, the children coming across the border, those kinds of things. Dave?
Well, ISIS.
ISIS.
You know, I thought what was really bad was not so much that he said in a New Yorker interview last winter that it was the junior varsity And you don't have to worry about the junior varsity. But later on, a few months later, when ISIS became more of a threat, the White House went through this whole thing about trying to about insisting that the comment was taken out of context. And then the New Yorker put out the full interview, and you could see the quote, and it was what it was.
Betsy, you want to weigh in on that? And then I do want to get to some of our callers, and we've got some email as well.
Yeah, I think going back to the Keystone issue, just 2 points. One, it's a great issue for Republicans because the Republican base is totally fine with Keystone. But two, we can't overstate how much of a problem this is for national Democrats, not just for the president, but also for Hillary Clinton. She did an interview with a Canadian publication called The Globe and Mail a couple months ago, and they asked her about Keystone. And she just kind of threw her hands up and said, I don't want to talk about that. I don't have an opinion. Please don't ask me that question. So it really electrifies a small but vocal part of the Democratic base, which is the environmentalists. I mean, I live in D.C., and when there's an anti-Keystone march, traffic is going to be a disaster,
really?
And there's going to be people waving signs, and you're not going to be able to go anywhere near the mall because it's so galvanizing for so many people. It's kind of, I mean, it's not the same, but you can also argue, I think, that it brings out similar sentiments that the Tea Party brings out on the right. Not the same, not the same scope, but similar headaches, perhaps.
And that's Betsy Woodruff, political writer for Slate. Also with us, Dick Pullman, political columnist for WHYY's newsworks.org. And it's Ballot Talks on Radio Times. We do this every Thursday, giving us all a chance to dissect and discuss and digest some political issues. And, of course, focusing a lot on Tuesday night's election results and what they all mean. We want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. Again, you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get Jiba from, looks like Sharon Hill, to join us. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi, Marty. Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Fine. My take on the election is that the Republican ran a very flawless campaign in that they focused on Obama. They pretty much told the voters that whatever is going on in Washington, D.C., regarding the dysfunction or the threat of ISIS, Ebola, blame Obama. I mean, they stuck on it until the night of election. As for the Democrats have nothing to run on. They have nothing to galvanize their base, other than just distancing themselves from Obama. So that took a toll on the Democratic voter. That's pretty much my take.
Okay, Jiba, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Picking up on what we were saying earlier, though, what I hear our callers saying is that the Democrats, if the Republicans were basically saying it's all Obama's fault, whatever it is, that the Democrats weren't kind of fighting back with something else.
Mm. Well, yeah, here you are. Here you have Democrats running from Obama, and all that does is tell the electorate or the swing voters, the independents, who, by the way, in this self-identified independents, voted 54% to 42% for Republican candidates. Okay, so swing voters. And so all that does when you're running from Obama and you're not making any kind of affirmative case, it confirms what independents, whatever disenchantment they have with the president. So, plus it degalvanizes, I guess you could say, the Democratic base, what they call the ascendant Obama coalition, or what has been known as that. So they're more likely to stay home. So you had in this midterm election, the total percentage of age-eligible voters was only 36.6%, which is the lowest in memory. I'm not sure how far back it goes in terms of the stats I've seen, but it's lowest than any of the ones that we can remember, 36%, and disproportionately Democratic-leaning voters stayed home, particularly young people. You always emphasize that. Young voters under age 30 who have been so pro-Obama, only 12%, 13% of them showed up nationwide. And it really killed off a lot of Democratic incumbents in places like Colorado, for example.
Betsy, tossing something else out on the table here is one of the arguments or analyses that I've read is that money won and records amounts of money spent on some particular races. And overall, I forget what the final tally is, but it's something like $4 billion. How much should we factor in money when talking about elections and election results?
I think it's important important to remember that just having an enormous amount of money to spend and sinking huge amounts of money into races doesn't necessarily change them. And the two top examples here are Tom Steyer, a billionaire from California who spent something like $57 million trying to make climate change an issue and totally failed. And you know, it just didn't work. Obviously, you look at the returns from Tuesday night. So that's $57 million down the tubes. And then Larry Lessig, who is a professor who started May Day PAC, which is actually designed to counter money in politics.
Right.
There's a lot of irony here, which he acknowledges. Yes. He raised $10 million, spent it, and basically everyone he supported lost. So on the one hand, yeah, we're spending tons and tons of money on politics. But on the other hand, just because you have a huge amount of money doesn't mean that you're going to actually get your public policy proposals put in place. Doesn't actually mean that your candidates are going to win. It's more complicated than just being able to put up a ton of TV ads.
And speaking of a ton of TV ads, and Dick, you always just wonder when it's just wall-to-wall ads, these 30-second ads, is that money well spent? I mean, most people by the end mm-hmm. of an election season are so sick of what they see on their TV, mm-hmm. they have to tune out. One wonders if ads change anybody's mind and if all this money is being spent, is it spent wisely?
Well, there have been the milestone for negative ads, or I shouldn't say milestone, but the first place that everybody really started paying huge amount of attention to, it was 1988. Which was Bush Sr. and Dukakis. And the Republicans aimed a ton of ads, negative ads, at Dukakis, particularly the one that's most well-known, Willie Horton ad. Yeah. And so after that, there were a lot of studies started coming out, and there still are, about do negative ads depress turnout? Do they change minds is the question you asked. And, you know, it's a complicated picture. Most of the ones say that that they're designed basically not so much to sway people's minds, but to confirm what their own side feels and to perhaps dissuade the other side from showing up at the polls at all. So, you know, there is some sort of, I guess, correlations between negative ads and lower turnout, particularly among the other side that's being swamped. But to go back, you know, but again, well, what Betsy said is, you know, is right. It doesn't necessarily mean that a swamp of negative ads is going to click, because it kind of depends on what the overall environment is. In 2012, Karl Rove and his group spent a ton of money, Sheldon Adelson, on Republicans, pro-Mitt Romney, et cetera, and it didn't impede Obama's reelection at all.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation with Dick Pullman and Betsy Woodruff, and we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times, our ballot talks on Radio Times, something we do every Thursday in this hour of the show, which is to dissect and discuss a whole bunch of election-related issues. And, of course, today we are talking about the election results on Tuesday night. And, again, talking with Betsy Woodruff. She's a political writer for Slate, and with Dick Pullman, political columnist for WHYY's Newsworks.org. And we've got calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Let me read an email from Joe, email address, radiotimes@whyy.org. He says, do you think young folks stayed home because most of Obama's promises to them failed? Betsy, do you think that was an issue, and do you think that's true?
I think there was certainly a perception that the president oversold what he could do, and maybe the number one issue where this comes up is on immigration, where pro-immigration reform activists, Hispanic activists, seemed absolutely irate when the president said he was going to push forward any sort of executive action until after the midterms. The Washington Post, maybe a month or two ago, had a story just detailing how specifically this was impacting many of the Hispanic activists who were significantly responsible for the president winning two presidential elections. In Colorado, it seems like Hispanics didn't come out. There was a sense they were being used politically instead of, you know, getting the specific things that they expected from the president. One group actually encouraged Hispanics not to vote in states like Louisiana, Arkansas, and North Carolina to punish the president because there was a perception that he double-crossed them. I don't know that I could quantify how much that specifically impacted people's votes, but the ire is really undeniable.
Well, and one wonders, because my understanding is that there was certain Democrats that asked the president not to go ahead on this because they were afraid it was going to mm-hmm. hurt
yep,
them
right.
in their districts. Dick, do you want to weigh in on that?
Well, I'll throw in one other complicating factor
sure,
on
ahead.
All this.
Love complications.
Because life, politics is complicated.
Yes.
Which is that you have to take into account, to some extent anyway, that the House is so solidly Republican that whatever immigration reform gets passed by the Senate, and the Senate indeed did pass a immigration reform bill, that the House Republicans are not going to move ahead on it. The House is so heavily constructed now of – because of gerrymandering and all that stuff, drawing of lines of congressional districts, it's very heavily dominated by safe red districts and drawn in a way where a lot of those congressmen don't have to worry about sort of an Hispanic voter backlash because the Hispanic vote has been distributed among all these districts. So they can they can adamantly talk amnesty and productively and come out effective politically on that by blocking immigration reform. And so I think what strikes me more broadly is that the Republican tactic of obstruction, whether it's conscious or just something that they do piece by piece, has actually worked for them politically. A lot of the common thought was that if they obstruct, the voters are going to punish them for it. Well, the voters this year did not punish them for it. So they've obstructed immigration reform, and here's Hispanics saying we're going to punish Obama. And so, I don't know how much of that was thought out by Republicans ahead of time, but it's worked out in the results.
You want to weigh in on that, Betsy? Then we'll get back to our callers.
I think just the one important detail to bear in mind here is that the word amnesty itself is kind of a squirrely term. On the right, you hear Republicans use that in a number of different ways. Some very far conservative groups that have a lot of clout in the House Republican caucus will say that anything short of promising to deport all illegal immigrants is amnesty. On the other hand, you have folks like Speaker Boehner, Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy, who will use the term amnesty, but they mean something much They mean a much smaller category of potential actions. So in the House Republican caucus, people use this term differently, and they mean to say different things when they use it. So anytime you hear Republicans talk about we're against amnesty or we're cracking down on it, it's important to take a look at what specific policies they're talking about, because Republican leadership has a much narrower definition of what amnesty is than, say, Congressman Steve King or Senator Jeff Sessions might.
But what I hear you saying, Dick, is that and this has been called what the least productive Congress in history or in many decades, is that that was sort of a goal of the Republican Party. Mm-hmm. And then the message from the voters is we want you to get stuff done. And then President Obama and the Democrats get punished for it. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's like, people are saying it's a complicated thing. People are saying stop all the bickering. And get stuff done. And, most people, and I don't mean this in any kind of bad way, but most people, they're not paying the kind of close attention to Washington as those of us who are sort of political junkies do. And so, they'll look at it and they'll go, the president he's the one that we elect. He's the one at the top of the pyramid. And so if nothing's getting done, he's the one in charge. The buck stops there. Mm. And so he ends up maybe taking a disproportionate amount of the blame, and maybe he does deserve, he does deserve a lot.
He kind of admitted that yesterday.
He deserves a lot of the blame, too. And there's even Democrats on Capitol Hill, it needs to be said, who will say that the White House has not been very good working with Congress. Obama was only in the Senate for a couple of years before he became president. He doesn't really know he can't speak the congressional language. And it may be that may be a test for the next – whoever we pick for the next president, we might want somebody who is a little bit more seasoned or knowledgeable or diplomatic about how to work with the Hill.
Let me get – looks like Gwen from West Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times or Ballot Talks on Radio Times. So go ahead, Gwen. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I just have a comment and a question. My comment is I was really, really disgusted and disheartened by the way the Democratic candidates ran away from President Obama. To me, there's no sense of any loyalty. It's every man for himself. And my question is to the guest, how much do you think racism, the idea that a black man is president, how much do you think racism has to do with the animus towards the president?
Well, Gwen, it's a really important question. I'm actually going to put that to you, Betsy, and I'm thinking of something that Senator Landrieu said in talking about voters in her state of Louisiana. Is there any way to know how much race is a factor?
I don't have any piece of quantifiable data where I could give an answer to that. However, I think without a doubt, we definitely see significant, almost arguably visceral distaste for the president in some of these southern states, especially Arkansas, West Virginia, and Louisiana, and Kentucky, where the Democratic nominee wouldn't say if she'd voted for the president, even though she was a delegate for him, mm-hmm. as has been pointed out. And I think whether racism is the problem or Democrats assuming that they need to win the votes of a voting bloc that they perceive as potentially racist, I think regardless, it's possible that could have influenced how much Democrats sort of bent over backwards to stay as far away from the president as possible.
Let me read an email. This is Alan from Glenside. He says, the Democrats need to fight for what they stand for, health care for all, punishing the criminal bankers who got away with their crimes and were rewarded with trillions of dollars in write-offs and subsidies, tax relief for the student loan crisis. The list goes on. But these three issues are political winners, but they won't fight for them. There's a kind of a theme that I hear, Dick, as we're talking about looking at the Democrats in this election and also the challenges, I guess, for them going ahead and how they connect or are disconnected from their voters.
Well, you know, midterm elections are all about getting your base out, you know, because, you know, the people who are sort of casually attached to politics are not going to show up. They're going to wait and vote in presidential years. So you've got to get your base out. And that's how you win. And you can't do it unless you have an affirmative, repetitive message for the people who you consider to be key in your coalition. And so when you go into a fetal position and and say, oh, please don't hit me, that doesn't do it. That doesn't do it for people. And so the Democrats unfortunately have a habit of doing that far more often than Republicans. Republicans have very reliable, maybe they're older whiter people in midterm elections, but they turn out. Republicans know how to connect with them. Republicans, whether you agree with them or not, they never make apologies for what they believe. You know, even when they were saying that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, they put it out there. And their voters hear it and they respond. And so the Democrats, you know, I don't know what it is. You know, a psychologist could have to work on that one, I think.
We'll have to put the Democratic Party, probably both parties, on the couch. Let me get Peter from Lumberton to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Peter. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning, Marty. Good morning. A 30-year listener. Love
30 years. Oh, my goodness. Have I been on the air that long?
I can't believe that I'm that old.
But, me neither.
Yeah, I just have a couple of comments. I am so angry, even 2 days later, about what happened on Tuesday, and I can't believe that the American people continue to vote against their own best interests. A good example of that was the 5 ballots for a raise of the minimum wage, which basically is controlled by legislatures, and people had to put it on the ballot to vote for it, and I believe they all passed, and I believe that 4 of them were in red states. And yet in those red states, those Republican legislators were reelected again.
Right.
So it just boggles my mind, and I just have one comment about what happened. There was no spokesman for the Democratic Party extolling what the president has done over the last 6 years under extremely difficult circumstances. And I think for Mitch McConnell to ask the president to cooperate with him after what they have done to him for 6 years is just awful. And when you have the drumbeat of Fox News just trying to kill this president in so many ways. He's not a citizen. He's an Arab. He's a Muslim. It's just mind-boggling to me what's happened.
Well, Peter, let me take your point because it's a good one, and we've got a lot of other callers I want to get on as well. But let me toss that to you, Betsy. We talked about this earlier. Dick was talking about the sort of disconnect here, but I'd be curious what you say back to Peter.
Yeah, I think that's totally true. And I think maybe one race where we especially see Democrats being shy of talking about policy and instead just, you know, throwing out a lot of platitudes and staying away from the president. One particular race is Colorado, where Senator Udall, a couple days before Election Day, actually got heckled at an event by one of his own donors. He was speaking to volunteers about his race, telling them to ignore the polls where he was doing badly. And then the one policy issue that he touched on, the only thing he wanted to talk about, was reproductive freedom, the term he used. And he says, by the way, you know, here's this one thing. I'm really proud to support reproductive freedom. And someone in the crowd yells, that's not your only issue. Jesus Christ. And the reporter afterward found this person, and the person was a top donor to the Democratic Party in Colorado. And he was so angry that Udall wasn't talking about their issues, you know, wasn't talking about the policies, wasn't making cases for Democrats to stay in power. So I think this frustration is very widespread, and I think Democrats' failure to really defend their specific policies, I think it absolutely was a huge problem for them.
In fact, Dick, the president has been criticized for not, for whatever reason, not telling people, for instance, what's in the Affordable Care Act that they actually might like, or either he says it and they don't hear it, or whatever. There seems to be, this disconnect.
Yeah, here's Kentucky, where hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people have been benefited, getting health insurance for the first time in their lives through a state program, but it was prompted by Obamacare. And then they turn around and they reelect, McConnell by a decisive margin, even after he said he was going to tear it out root and branch. And so it's very, very odd. But the White House has to be, you know, I understand what the last caller was talking about and, you know, demonizing Obama and all that. But, you know, that is potentially best countered by having a consistent affirmative message. And Obama over the last 3 or 4 years and the Democratic operation of the White House has been very poor at articulating the 4 or 5 pieces of Obamacare that people really are starting to, you know, 11 million people have signed up. You know, they're starting to benefit. Why haven't they been out there year after year? You know, the Republicans are great on a simple, repetitive message, and Democrats aren't. Mm-hmm. So they're not selling something that's going to be, I think, in the long term, considered a revolutionary, proactively revolutionary piece of legislation.
Betsy, let me go back to you, and I have a very specific question about Joni Ernst. She is going to be the senator representing Iowa, and she's got a pretty eye-opening paper trail here. She's in the past called President Obama dictator. She has apparently still believes there are weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and on and on and on from there. I'm just curious about how you see her and even how you see her fitting in to the U.S. Senate and even working with Mitch McConnell.
Yeah, I think Republican leaders in D.C. are very excited about Joni Ernst, particularly more neoconservative, hawkish Republicans see her as someone who's going to be one of their own. And I don't think they're too stressed about some of these gaffes that she's made in the past. One thing that's really important about Ernst, and the one issue where she could be a problem for Republicans in D.C., is that she came out publicly a few months ago in favor of taking military sexual assault cases out of the chain of command. And that's something that definitely puts her at odds with her party. And she has a lot of credibility to talk about that issue as a woman who has served in the military, who's been in combat. So if there's a situation where she's going to be a problem for national Republicans, that's what it is. Even though Ernst has said some wacky, weird, indefensible things in the past, she ran a very disciplined campaign, especially compared to her Democratic competitor, Bruce Braley. And I think she's probably going to keep her head down when she's in the Senate. However, if military sexual assault becomes an issue again, then it's going to be all eyes on her, and it's going to be very tricky for national Republicans to be at odds with someone who's obviously very pro-military but also thinks that this significant change should be made.
We're almost out of time here. This is for you, Dick. So are we seeing the outlines, the mirage, the fuzzy-wuzzies of the 2016 presidential campaign getting started?
What a fine way to end. Because I think the starting gate is opened already. I think it's going to be very interesting to see. And I want to sort of write about this, and I haven't figured out what the hell. Excuse me.
To think about this
is how this all affects Hillary Clinton's political fortunes in particular, because there's an argument here to be made that she is in a good position, that if there's a lot of dysfunction in the next 2 years, and we can pretty much bet there will be a fair bit, that she can now sort of run again. You know, I'm the seasoned candidate, and I can play off this dysfunction that the Republicans are going to have to shoulder a lot of the blame for.
Well, to be continued, my thanks to both of you. Dick Pullman, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Sure thing.
Political columnist for WHYY's newsworks.org. Betsy Woodruff, thank you for joining us as well.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And she's a political writer for Slate. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back.